Cold War, but it shifted to offense simultaneous with expansion into the former Warsaw Pact. A dangerous precedent was created, Gorbachev observed, of military action undertaken against a sovereign country without authorization by the UN Security Council in violation of the UN Charter and international law. Putin would soon exploit the precedent in carrying out his own liberations. NATO's actions in the former Yugoslavia, in Bosnia in 1995, as well as in Serbia in 1999, were undertaken with noble aims, to stop the slaughter of innocents. NATO expansion into the former Warsaw Pact, however, added to these attacks a toxic element for U.S.-Russia relations. The new Eastern members were not capable of affecting the outcomes, yet as part of the alliance, they were now bound to Western policies that challenged Russian interests. As NATO expanded further eastward, nations on Russia's borders would also become tied to such policies. NATO members would, moreover, take unilateral actions hostile to Russia, actions they would never have taken outside the alliance. In 2012, Syria shot down a Turkish jet over its territory. An angry President Recep Tayyip Erdogan insisted that a short-term border violation could never be a pretext for an attack. Yet 3 years later, Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet that had crossed into its airspace from Syria, where it was bombing opponents of the Assad regime. Turkey could claim to have acted in self-defense and without territorial ambitions, but it also acted knowing that it could call on NATO protection under the collective defense principle of Article 5, in the event of Russian military retaliation. Turkish airspace is NATO airspace, the Turkish Foreign Ministry told Russia after the attack. Russia took notice. Turkey has not set itself up as the actor, but the North Atlantic Alliance as a whole, observed Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. This is extremely irresponsible. In a 1997 statement before a NATO gathering in Brussels, Albright argued that the purpose of NATO expansion was to do for Europe's East what NATO did 50 years ago for Europe's West, to integrate new democracies, eliminate old hatreds, provide confidence in economic recovery, and deter conflict. But this was the purpose of the Marshall Plan and not NATO. And if the aim were now to repeat such accomplishments in the East, NATO, a military organization built to defend its members against the Soviet Union, was an awkward vehicle to achieve it. It could possibly deter conflict, but it might also encourage conflict with a distrustful and better-armed Russia. If we are talking about the importance of improving the economies and democratization of countries like Hungary and Poland, Senator Paul Wellstone, Democrat, Minnesota, put to Albright at hearings that year, there is the European Union. I do not know how a military alliance really meets these concerns. Conflating NATO expansion and the Marshall Plan suggested a mismatch between means and ends. Senator Paul Sarbanes, Democrat, Maryland, added that he could not understand Albright's suggestion that the 50th anniversary of the Marshall Plan is relevant to the timing of NATO expansion. Well, Albright clarified, we have been celebrating the 50th anniversary of everything. If historical anniversaries were important for NATO expansion, waiting 2 years for the 80th anniversary of the Versailles Treaty would have been more apposite. The treaty heaped humiliations on Germany after World War I, with no clear end in sight, and created the economic and political conditions that led to World War II. Having improbably abandoned communism for democracy and capitalism in a near bloodless revolution, Russians were, 10 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, feeling similarly humiliated and threatened by an unexpected Western military advance toward their borders. The European Union, in contrast to NATO, did have the capacity to provide a Marshall Plan for the East, but was unwilling. The EU's focus was on deepening economic and political integration within its existing boundaries. Membership for former Warsaw Pact nations would not come for another 7 years. Richard Holbrooke, the Clinton administration's most aggressive advocate of NATO enlargement, believed that EU membership was more important for Eastern Europe than NATO membership. But once it became clear to him that it was not going to happen anytime soon, he pronounced it irresponsible and politically dangerous to leave these countries outside the West. He concluded that NATO enlargement had to fill the void. Or as Albright put it, if NATO enlargement can proceed more quickly than EU enlargement, why wait until, say, tomato farmers in Central Europe start using the right kinds of pesticides for EU membership? That it might not be prudent to fill the political and economic void with a military pact did not concern them. George Marshall and Dean Acheson would never have backed NATO in place of a political and economic strategy. Western European integration was their aim, and the Truman administration only added a military element after the Prague coup showed that Moscow would subvert governments that could not defend themselves. In 1997, however, the Clinton administration insisted that Russia was threatening no one and did not need to be contained. This NATO, newly expanded to the east, Albright said, is not directed against Russia. It is not us versus them or them versus us. We are all on the same side. An influential Rand Corporation study published that same year, co-authored by Asmus, controversially estimated only modest NATO expansion costs on the grounds that the alliance had no enemy. The premise was avoiding confrontation with Russia, not preparing for a new Russian threat. Many of NATO's expansion's most prominent advocates, however, could not abide this thinking. Clinton officials keep talking about the absence of dividing lines, observed Henry Kissinger at the time. But with all due respect, this is nonsense. If you have an alliance, you have a dividing line. And Russia was on the other side of the line, just as it was in 1949. The difference was that the Marshall planners and NATO founders acknowledged that a line was being drawn and were willing to bear the necessary costs to defend it. The Clinton administration, in contrast, was denying the line's existence. The United States could have its cake and eat it too, Holbrooke said. Writing in 1998, he argued that, years from now, people will look back at the debate and wonder what all the fuss was about. They will notice that nothing has changed in Russia's relationship with the West. In 2000, just 2 years later, an official Russian foreign policy concept, FPC, paper, approved by President Putin, contradicted Holbrooke, declaring that NATO's present-day political and military guidelines do not coincide with security interests of the Russian Federation and occasionally contradict them. It pointed specifically to NATO's use of force operations outside of area without the sanction of the UN Security Council, a reference to NATO's bombing of Serbia, which began hours after Holbrooke announced that negotiations with its leadership over Kosovo had failed. Such out-of-area action, it must be noted, had always been envisioned by the architects of NATO expansion. In Asmus' words 7 years later, NATO must go out of our area or out of business, the presumption being that the latter had to be prevented by finding enemies. The FPC concluded that Russia retains its negative attitude towards the expansion of NATO. Asmus' 1997 estimate of NATO expansion costs, based on the belief that Russia would not seriously oppose it, naturally turned out to be way too low. 11 years later, in 2008, he explained in Foreign Affairs that the West's broader hopes of establishing deeper relations with a more democratic and cooperative Moscow never materialized. Moscow has instead become more authoritarian and adversarial. He continued to support NATO expansion to Russia's borders, but retreating from his 1997 paper, now recognized that anti-democratic forces in Russia, presumably the Putin government, will oppose such a move. This conclusion was a tepid acknowledgement that NATO and Russia had indeed become enemies, though he postulated remarkably that U.S. policy toward Ukraine would help ameliorate this problem. Consolidating a pro-Western democratic Ukraine, he asserted, will indirectly encourage democratization in Russia. By 2016, that pretense was demolished. Rand published a study that year backing billions of dollars in additional annual NATO spending aimed at reinforcing deterrence on NATO's eastern flank, a direct response to Russia's aggression against Ukraine. Yet there was no sign that the United States was willing to bear such spending, once again highlighting a critical difference between NATO's founders and its expanders. But many in the Clinton administration believed that NATO enlargement was necessarily less to protect Eastern Europe than to promote and entrench democracy there, even in Russia, which would remain outside it. The deepest aim of NATO enlargement, Russia expert Stephen Sistanovich writes, may well have been to consolidate the victory of Western ideas. Yet there is no evidence that it did, nor have the mechanics by which it was supposed to accomplish this feat ever been revealed. Remaining outside NATO has had no detrimental effect on democracy or Western ideas in Sweden or Finland. Meanwhile, Turkey, no liberal democracy when it joined NATO in 1952, became less of one under Erdogan's leadership. Poland regressed under the Law and Justice, PIS, government after 2015. And membership imposed no constraint on Hungary when its prime minister, Viktor Orban, declared in 2014 that the era of liberal democracies is over. Orban did not think that Hungary's European Union membership, or by extension its NATO membership, precludes it from building an illiberal new state based on national foundations, which is what he now wished for his country. Moreover, he said, what is happening right now regarding Russia's relations to the West is really bad for Hungary. This conclusion is, of course, precisely the one Moscow wanted the Hungarian government to draw. Whereas Western supporters of enlargement like Asmus argued that Russia had a vested interest in supporting democratic stability on its Western border, Moscow pursued a different strategy, encouraging authoritarian tendencies or political unreliability in its neighbors. Particularly in Georgia and Ukraine, Moscow's ambition was to keep the regimes institutionally weak, unpalatable to the West, and dependent on Russia. Whereas Orban's comments were condemned by many of Hungary's neighbors, Orban succeeded in clarifying that NATO was a military alliance whose political impact was mainly on relations between Russia and the countries that joined or might wish to join. It was not an organization with either the will or capacity to make or keep countries democratic. In 1992, Slavic language-speaking insurgents, supported by Russian troops, seized control of the Transnistria region of largely Romanian-speaking Moldova on the southern border of Ukraine. Though the region's assertion of independence has never been recognized internationally, Russia supports Transnistria economically and maintains an estimated 2,000 armed personnel on the ground, including 400 to 500 peacekeepers under the 1992 ceasefire agreement. Since 2008, Russia has created two new frozen conflicts in bordering former Soviet republics, Georgia and Ukraine, on the Moldovan model. All three serve an important strategic purpose in keeping NATO and the European Union from expanding further eastward. Following the so-called Rose Revolution of 2003, the Georgian government of President Mikhail Saakashvili initiated a military modernization program using American hardware in conjunction with the campaign for NATO membership. With the aim of demonstrating its commitment and capabilities, Georgia contributed forces and equipment to American-led interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq. This military assistance sent a clear signal to Moscow that it was both aligning its policies with Washington and opening up another front for Western forces on Russia's borders. By 2008, Kremlin officials considered their efforts to dissuade the Georgian government from joining NATO a failure, creating a sense of urgency. Given that the country could call upon Article 5 security guarantees after joining the alliance, the window for low-cost Russian military intervention was closing, In March, the breakaway republics of Abkhazia, largely Russophone, and South Ossetia appealed for Russian recognition of their independence from Georgia, citing the precedent of Kosovo. By August, mounting tensions between Tbilisi and Moscow escalated to war, resulting in a Kremlin-orchestrated standoff marked by ever-growing political, economic, and security ties between Russia and the two effectively autonomous republics. Gorbachev, whose urgings against NATO expansion had been treated as domestic posturing in Washington, backed Russian military action in Georgia. More recently, Russia followed a similar template in Ukraine. Political crisis in the country erupted in November 2013 after intense pressure from Russia, its main energy provider, persuaded President Viktor Yanukovych to abandon an association agreement with the European Union. A struggle between pro-EU forces in the country, mostly in the West, and pro-Russia forces, mostly in the East, led to Yanukovych fleeing the capital in February 2014. Russia denounced his departure as a White House-orchestrated coup and responded by annexing Crimea in March. Aided by Russian soldiers and materiel, pro-Russian separatist forces in the eastern Donbas region began seizing territory in May. This was a crisis that Kennan had seen coming, having in 1999, at age 95, decried the thoughtless tossing of the un-Ukrainian Crimean Peninsula into Ukraine after the breakup of the Soviet Union. While the conflicts in Moldova, Georgia, and Ukraine have been attributed to aggressive Kremlin efforts to reestablish elements of the Soviet Empire, it is notable that none of the breakaway regions, with the exception of Crimea, which houses the Russian Black Sea Fleet, has been annexed by Russia. The reason is that annexation of pro-Russian territories would have strengthened the pro-Western forces in the remaining parts of each country. Annexation therefore stymies Russia's primary objective, which is keeping the countries beyond the reach of Western institutions seen to threaten Russian interests. The presence of frozen conflicts in the three nations effectively blocks them from joining with the West. In the case of NATO, the alliance has always rejected aspirants with unresolved border disputes, internal territorial conflicts, and insufficient military capacity to provide for a credible national defense. In the cases of Georgia and Ukraine, the timing of the Russian interventions coincided with their achievement of tangible benchmarks on the path to EU and NATO membership. The combined separatist territories, under effective Russian control, now form a valuable protective arc along Russia's western and southwestern border. Just as Stalin strengthened the Soviet Union's buffer zone in response to the Marshall Plan, which he expected Washington to supplement with military force, Putin has strengthened Russia's buffer zone in response to NATO expansion. In 2016, on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of the end of the Cold War, the German daily Bild interviewed Vladimir Putin. What, he was asked, had gone wrong in relations between Russia and the West? Everything, Putin responded. The Berlin Wall fell, but invisible walls were moved to the east of Europe. Moscow, he insisted, had been promised that NATO would not expand eastward, a reference to alleged commitments from then-NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner and U.S. Secretary of State James Baker. But NATO and the United States, Putin said, decided that they alone would sit on the throne of Europe. They went back on their word. This has led to mutual misunderstandings and assignments of guilt. They are the cause of all crises ever since. Putin's view was wholly consistent with how Soviet officials perceived the shift in U.S. policy toward Europe back in 1946. Having expected FDR to withdraw American troops within 2 years after the war's end, they were now convinced Truman wanted to preserve U.S. military potential in Europe as a necessary base for carrying out aggressive aims in the future. Putin's perspective was also a pointed challenge to Holbrooke's prediction, 18 years earlier, that NATO expansion would have no effect on Russia's relationship with the West. Everyone would look back and wonder what all the fuss was about. At the time Putin spoke, Ukraine was the focus of tension between Russia and the West. He justified annexing Crimea by pointing to NATO action the year after Holbrooke's prediction. Serbia was bombarded and attacked with missiles, Putin said. It was a military intervention of the West and NATO against the then rump Yugoslavia. Why, he asked, if the Kosovars have the right to self-determination, should the people of Crimea not have it? The implication was that if NATO could go to war to move borders, it was in no position to condemn others for acting in support of the same principle, self-determination. Rather than challenge the American idea of a liberal international order that respected national sovereignty, he exploited an apparent contradiction. Following the annexation, conflict between Russia and Ukraine over NATO intensified. In November 2014, Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov told the BBC that Russia wanted a 100% guarantee that no one would think about Ukraine joining NATO. Such an expansion was a dangerous attempt to break the balance of power. 1 month later, the Ukrainian parliament voted to end the country's non-aligned status, a preliminary step toward joining the alliance. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov condemned the move as counterproductive, saying it only worsens confrontation. In June 2016, he clarified that Russia did not consider the existence of NATO a threat, but that the doctrines of Russian security are clearly written, and one of the main threats is the further expansion of NATO to the east. What do the Americans need NATO for? Putin asked Shimon Peres in a private conversation shortly before the latter's death that year. The Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. The Warsaw Pact was dismantled. I am ready to be a member of NATO. But why do they need Georgia in NATO? Why do they need Romania in NATO? If Georgia and Romania want to go to Europe, let them go to Europe. But which army do they want to fight? The Americans think I didn't know that Crimea is Russian and that Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine as a gift. I didn't care until the Americans needed the Ukrainians in NATO. What for? I didn't touch them. They wanted to go to Europe. I said, great, go to Europe. But why did the Americans need them in NATO? Kennan, who had died only a decade earlier, age 101, would not have been surprised at the rising tensions. In 1997, he had written an op-ed in the New York Times arguing that expanding NATO would be the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-Cold War era. Kennan predicted that it would inflame nationalistic, anti-Western, and militaristic tendencies in Russian opinion, have an adverse effect on the development of Russian democracy, restore the atmosphere of Cold War to East-West relations, and impel Russian foreign policy in directions decidedly not to our liking. In figures such as longtime Yeltsin Foreign Minister Andrei Kodzirev and economic and political reformers Yegor Gaidar and Anatoly Chubais, Washington had interlocutors in Moscow not unlike Litvinov, Maisky, and Gromyko in the 1940s. Figures who viewed cooperation with the West as Russia's most promising course. But NATO expansion undermined their credibility at home. The subsequent two decades would see a different, more nationalist and confrontational breed of politicians in the Kremlin. The Marshall Plan aimed at aiding American military disengagement from Europe, yet ended up, through NATO, making it both deeper and enduring. That Moscow believed Washington had planned this all along only helped make it so. Stalin's aggressive reaction to the plan convinced Western leaders that the increased U.S. military commitment he feared had now become vital to their economic and physical security. Given this history, it should not be surprising that EU expansion a half century later also created conflict with Russia. As with the Marshall Plan and NATO, the EU has, for all practical purposes, been a body open to all European nations, save Russia. The EU began negotiations in 1998, shortly after Albright's Harvard speech, with the 10 Central and Eastern European countries, Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia, that would join in 2004 and 2007. Tensions with Russia began rising almost immediately, as they had after Marshall's speech in 1947. Russia, it was clear, would lose political and economic leverage with countries on its border that were pooling sovereignty with the EU and its institutions. The foreign policy concept paper approved by Putin in 2000 highlighted a lack of adequate respect for the interests of the Russian side in the process of the EU expansion. Seeing a connection with the simultaneous enlargement of NATO, the paper further suggested that the EU's emerging military-political dimension should become an object of particular attention. In 2000 and 2001, EU aspirant nations Estonia, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia imposed visa requirements on Russian visitors. The Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the action, likening it to the erection of a new Berlin Wall. Economic restrictions followed travel restrictions as the EU bound the newcomers to its trade and investment regimes. Rejecting EU arguments that it would benefit from lower average tariffs in the East European accession states, Russia insisted it would face higher ones on its most important exports. It estimated annual export losses from extending the EU common tariff to the 10 new Eastern member states at 200 million euros to 300 million euros. It also criticized new technical standard barriers and potential anti-dumping levies. Critical Russian interests, such as energy exports to and through the East, would be infringed further and further through time. The first U.S. liquid natural gas, LNG, tanker to pass through the Baltic Sea in 2016 would be greeted as a major political event in Europe. A game changer, according to the EU's energy chief, a Slovak. U.S. LNG is more than just about gas, said the mayor of the Lithuanian port town that would receive the American ships. It's about freedom. As former Soviet satellites and republics shed their dependence on Russia, traditional Kremlin sanctions to discipline their behavior, like trade bans and gas embargoes, would lose their effectiveness. Russia would therefore resort to new and tougher methods, such as covert propaganda campaigns, espionage, cyber warfare, and political threats, to prevent Western imports from threatening its lucrative monopolies in the East. Politically, much would change with EU expansion as well, to Russia's detriment. Rotating leadership roles within the EU would frequently place its policies in the hands of hostile states, such as Poland and Latvia. The 2000 FPC had called it an indispensable condition of good neighborliness and mutual cooperation between Russia and the Baltic states for there to be respect for the rights of the Russian-speaking population within the three neighboring nations. As Russian-speaking communities in such states, often large, became increasingly marginalized, pressure grew in Russia to intervene on their behalf. Such radical changes in Russia's external environment were bound to have security implications, much as the Marshall Plan had. An isolated Russia would seek to retain and regain influence in its region, while the rest of Europe would insist on upholding its sovereign prerogatives. European politicians thought that the creation of the so-called Belt of Friendly Countries on the outer borders of the EU would reliably guarantee security, said Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev in 2016. But what were the results of this policy? An exclusion zone with local conflicts and economic trouble on the eastern and southern borders. Much as Moscow sought to undermine Churchill's reactionary venture to create a United States of Europe in 1947, it today seeks to create an arc of instability along its western frontier to subvert EU expansion. Far from welcoming closer ties between its neighbors and the EU, as early expansion advocates argued it should and would, Russia threatened to block Ukrainian access to its market if it went forward with plans to enter a free trade arrangement with the EU. To punish Russia for its military and political intervention in the country, the West hit Russia with economic and financial sanctions. The EU has rejected Russian criticism of its expansion. European nations, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said, denied any obligation to ask Moscow first before acting. That's how it was for 40 years, and I don't want to go back to that. For countries caught between Russia and the EU, the standoff is dangerous. We don't want somebody over our heads to decide that we will never join, said Georgia's EU ambassador Natalie Sabanadze, that we will never be part of the Euro-Atlantic community. Here again was the self-perpetuating dialectic of fear and threat, accusation and response, action and reaction, that characterized the early Cold War. Western political and security interests, as the Marshall planners learned, are difficult to separate. Not surprisingly, elites in Russia, Germany, and the United States have long seen the EU and NATO as two sides of the same coin. This highlights the challenge to the European Union in Eastern expansion. The deeper the penetration, the deeper the conflict with Russian interests. If not controlled through negotiation and compromise, conflict spills into the security sphere. Communism is gone from Europe, but geography has not changed. Russia is, as it has always been, too large and powerful to embed within Western institutions without fundamentally changing them, and too vulnerable to Western encroachment to acquiesce in its own exclusion. Advancing new means of positive engagement will, therefore, require a difficult, perhaps impossible, reimagining of Cold War legacy institutions. In contrast with the early Cold War period, the post-Cold War period has been marked by the absence of an American grand strategy, a calibrated mapping of means to large ends. Over the course of 1946 and 1947, the United States developed a framework of Soviet containment to safeguard its interests without appeasement or war. It then devised the Marshall Plan as the most promising means, given Soviet conventional military superiority in Europe and a large American edge in economic power to implement it. When France and Britain averred that economic integration made Marshall nations more dependent on each other and less able to defend themselves against hostile action by Russia or Germany, the United States responded with NATO. Together, the Marshall Plan and NATO provided the means to carry out containment. Yet in the quarter century since the passing of the Soviet Union, grand strategy has been set aside in favor of improvisation to pacify competing interests. Democratization has been conflated with security objectives, serving neither. The result is an under-resourced NATO facing growing pressure from an increasingly embittered and authoritarian Russia. "We have signed up to protect a whole series of countries," observed Kennan in 1998, "even though we have neither the resources nor the intention to do so in any serious way." He was right. In consequence, the expansion policy is failing. The Marshall Plan is remembered as one of the great achievements of American foreign policy, not merely because it was visionary, but because it worked. It worked because the United States aligned its actions with its interests and capacities in Europe, accepting the reality of a Russian sphere of influence into which it could not penetrate without sacrificing credibility and public support. Great acts of statesmanship are grounded in realism, no less than idealism. It is a lesson we need to relearn.
The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War, was written by Ben Steele and read by Arthur Morey. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.